Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be speaking with two of the three authors of a fascinating new book just out from Manchester University Press titled The Social Significance of Dining Out, A Study of Continuity and Change. The book is written by Dr. Alan Ward, Dr. Jessica Paddock, and Dr. Jennifer Willens about dining out in England and how people think about this, how people's behaviors have changed, comparing responses between a whole bunch of different people in London, Bristol, and Preston from 1995 to 2015. This is a really interesting book that packs quite a lot in a very accessible way and somehow manages to do it in not even like 800 pages. It's very readable. And I'm very excited to dive into its many findings with two of the authors, Dr. Alan Ward and Dr. Jessica Paddock. So welcome both of you to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan, could you maybe start us off by introducing yourself and your team a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Certainly, thank you. Yes, so I'm Alan Ward. I'm an emeritus professor at the University of Manchester and a professorial fellow at the Sustainable Consumption Institute in Manchester. I'm a scholar studying consumption in particular and eating out and all sorts of aspects of food habits in particular. I come to this book because I did a study earlier on with data from 1995 as part of the Nation's Diet Programme of the Economic ESRC, Economic and Social Science Research Council. Anyway, I did that with Lydia Martins, who's now a professor at the University of Kiel. And at the time, it was a very unusual and unique study. Sociologists hadn't taken any notice, really, of eating out as an activity. And we were doing quite pioneering work. And it was a study of the three cities that Miranda just mentioned, and various aspects of the activity of eating out. The book that came out was called Eating Out, Social Differentiation, Consumption and Pleasure. And pleasure was an important part of that account. I got the opportunity to repeat the study courtesy of the Sustainable Consumption Institute in the early 2010s. And the aim was to repeat the similar methodologies, similar lines of inquiry, to see what had changed. Social change is one of the other things I'm interested in. And I did that with two of the research fellows at the Sustainable Consumption Institute. The one who can't be with us is Jen Willens, who is now a lecturer at the University of Bristol, as is Jessica. And she was she works on time use, but she was particularly responsible in this study for the statistical analysis of the data that we collected. Jessica Jess can speak for herself, but we conducted an extended empirical research project about which there was plenty to report, and the book that we're discussing is, in a sense, that report.
Wonderful, thank you. Jessica, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, yes, thank you. I'm Jessica Paddock, a sociologist, and I'm working at the intersection of the sociology of food and eating, consumption, and issues of environmental sustainability or unsustainability. I'm especially interested in the reproduction of inequalities as they're figured in practices of eating. And I'm now based at the University of Bristol. And prior to that, I was the one of the research fellows on this project, as Alan mentioned. And I was especially excited to be part of this project, given it's rather a seminal text in the study of sociology of food and eating. And it was really exciting for me to be part of the revisit of that study. And too often in sociology, as Alan said, we neglect to explore the organisation of practices that give us pleasure. And eating out is part of the tapestry of eating practices in our daily lives that belong to that category, we think. And revisits are really quite rare in the social sciences. So this was a really nice opportunity to think about and study social change and develop research methodologies that can really help us to think about how we go about studying change in a practice.
Mm. It was, in fact, the idea of revisiting something that attracted me initially to the book, because it is so rare in the social sciences to see something like this. And even without it being about eating out, which is also something I quite enjoy in my daily life, I was really interested purely sort of from a methodological point of view. And then, of course, I read the book and was like, oh, and also as someone who lives in Britain and eats out, there are multiple ways in which I find this interesting and relevant. But I would like to start with that sort of methodological aspect. Can you tell us more about the methodologies used in the project and the book?
Yes. Well, as we embarked on this project, the revisit, as we now call it, we spent a good deal of time really sort of thinking about, you know, how would we do this? You know, is this a restudy? Is this... how exactly would we revisit this study, given that in 1995 very little was known about the practice of dining out? There was no systematic social science research exploring the practice. So in 1995 the research began with an in-depth exploratory qualitative set of interviews in Preston only, and once some understanding of the matter was established, then a survey was designed and administered to 1,100 households across London, Preston and Bristol. So these cities were chosen so as to generate data that would speak to regional differences between, you know, metropolitan, provincial cities, you know, just to give a sense of how a practice was organised in a different setting. So it didn't make sense to do a study that was, say, nationally representative, because we wanted to understand the practice within a location, within its sort of in situ, as it were. And when we decided to come towards the revisit, we reversed that methodology, given that we knew a lot more about the practice from the first study. We actually started with the survey across the three cities, and then I followed up with respondents from that survey and interviewed them. We asked very similar questions as 1995. So key elements of the survey ask them questions about eating at home, their social activities, divisions of labour in the home. We asked them about eating out, also about takeaway food. And the survey really concentrated on the last main meal eaten at a public establishment and the last main meal eaten at someone else's home. And the survey ended with gathering data related to sociodemographics and social capital and so forth. And in 2015, given that we take this as a revisit rather than an exact replication of the 1995 study, that's the word I was looking for earlier, replication, we modified this research design to reflect more contemporary concerns as well. But in this way, we added categories rather than taking things away. So, for example, in the survey, we would ask about veganism, not just vegetarianism, for example. We would ask about other kinds of household activities around recycling and things like that, that we probably wouldn't have asked in 1995, or that Alan and Lydia didn't ask in 1995. So I think that's that for now.
No, a very, very useful summary. And of course, quite helpful theoretically to think about kind of the idea of revisit as a concept. So thank you for starting us off with that. Moving then from methodology to some of the findings, can you tell us, I guess, less statistically, sort of more meaning, what does it mean to people surveyed and asked in these ways to eat out? What did it mean then? What does it mean now? What are we actually kind of talking about when it comes to meaning people put on this?
Well, in 1995, eating out was considered very much an activity undertaken for pleasure, as it is now as well. But it wasn't in any way a routine activity. There was a dislike of formality, a real sense of indulgence of time. Eating out was mainly for special occasions. And like in 1995, we focused on main meals. That's an important distinction for us. In the qualitative interviews, we would ask respondents to tell us what they considered a main meal to be and what they considered eating out to be, in order to kind of gather a sense of these meanings. And just like in 1995, in 2015, main meals were widely understood as the largest meals of the day, eaten in the evening, and were more likely than not a hot meal. Now, while sort of the frequency of reported eating out hasn't increased significantly, this was one of our surprising findings, given that when we'd speak to anyone in the street or speak to our relatives, speak to our friends and say that we're doing this study on eating out and social change, they'd say, well, gosh, it's changed so much. And actually our findings, when it came to frequency, didn't show a huge difference. Instead, what we observed was, as you just hinted at, a change in meanings. So to start telling you that story, we observed changes in purpose. I'm speaking about the survey now as a basis for this more qualitative discussion in a second. We observed changes in purpose with more social occasions, more quick and convenient meals, and fewer special occasions in 2015. So we also see this simplification, or what we call informalization, of eating main meals out, according to various measures in the survey, but also in the qualitative interviews, and features such as less dressing up, less planning in advance, more one-course meals, less time spent at the table. So that data kind of tells us, or we argue with this data, that this speaks to the changing meaning of eating out. So while frequency hasn't changed all that much, how people out has. So to give a little bit more detail, maybe respondents were asked whether the reason for their most recent eating out occasion was for a special occasion or just a social occasion, for a convenience or a quick meal, a business meeting meal, or some other reason that they would specify. But the proportion of last meals in restaurants that were described as special occasions fell, convenience and quick increased, and the proportion which were just social occasions and business remained largely unchanged. So talking then to interviewees about their eating out revealed two forms that we considered distinct then from these special meals. So given that special occasions and convenience, quick events kind of flipped between 1995 and 2015. And through the qualitative interviews, I really got the sense that we developed these categories of these impromptu and regularized social occasions. So the impromptu occasions, for example, these are the kinds of meal event or eating out event that vary in the extent to which the meal was anticipated, planned in advance. And this highlights for us issues of scheduling and synchronization of different competing tasks and obligations in daily life. So grabbing a bite to eat in a cafe in between work and an evening event or a hobby, for example. Whereas this other kind of more casual type of event, this convenience, quick, or sort of event, is what we call the regularized social occasion. And this is similarly less precisely planned, but it's accomplished through regular appointments, such as weekly family get-togethers, fortnightly dates with a partner, monthly dinners with friends, and so on. It's those sorts of occasions. It's the changing meaning of that eating out event.
Hmm. Thank you for explaining that. I think it's a really interesting kind of what has changed and therefore what people assume what else has changed. Like, oh, the meaning has changed, therefore so has the frequency as well. And being able to kind of untangle that a bit. So Alan, I'm wondering if there's anything else you can tell us about who eats out most frequently, what kinds of places people go, and in what ways this has or has not changed?
Surely I can. In terms of frequency, and it's probably worth saying it's frequency of dining out. We changed the language between 1995 and 2015 to emphasize the fact that it's main meals. I mean, one reason why there's a popular perception that people eat out more often than they used to is because they now are much more likely to eat out for breakfast or probably in the middle of the day. But frequency of dining out, having a main meal, we should say that almost everybody does this. Some people do it a lot and some people do it relatively rarely. The sorts of social factors that increase frequency of eating out in a main meal, and these are more or less the same in both years, are belonging to professional managerial class, having a higher income, having experienced higher education, identifying as white British, being young or younger, not having any children, and in addition, it depends a bit how you feel about eating out. So we asked a set of attitude questions, for want of a better word, same questions in 1995 and 2015. The same, there are significant shifts there, or some shifts, but the more you were adventurous about eating, the more frequently you would eat out. So some people are fairly conservative and fairly cautious. That's a significant basis for restricting frequency of eating out. And if you like food, you may do it more frequently. Gender makes very little difference, though there was men were slightly more likely to eat out frequently in 1995, and there was no difference by 2015. What kinds of places? Well, people eat out both on commercial premises and in other people's homes. We think eating in other people's homes is particularly interesting, actually. Though when asked where their last meal was in 2015, fewer were in domestic contexts with your friends or with your non-resident family, and rather more in restaurants, cafes, and the like. We gave people a long list of the kinds of types of places they might eat out. Sure. Pub, bar in a hotel, wine bar, pizza house, fast food shop, so on and so forth. They're the most popular places to eat are actually casual dining restaurants. That was a concept that wasn't in existence in 1995, but people now are very likely to say many of the chains, many of the middle-priced and lower-priced chains would be described as casual dining restaurants. They're very popular. Pub restaurants and the bar meals in pubs are also particularly popular. So when people are dining out, they're not mostly dining out in fine dining restaurants. They're not going to Michelin star restaurants. They're going to much more ordinary places. The other thing that we think is very interesting about the different places is the kind of cuisine that's served. And we asked people in the survey what sort of cuisine was served to you the last time you ate out, and how often have you been, in the last year, have you eaten out in a traditional British restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, an Italian restaurant, a Thai restaurant, an American restaurant? So there's both type of place and style of cuisine, and sometimes they match up. Sometimes they don't. I mean, if you think of a pub menu, the type of dish you might have selected could be from many different kinds of cuisines. Among the interesting things in terms of difference is that people are simply more aware of, are more likely to have gone to restaurants serving foreign cuisines of different sorts. The range has actually increased, we think, in that 20-year period, and people are much more likely to have gone to something that would have been called an ethnic restaurant 20 or 30 years ago, though the term is now very difficult to use. There's no doubt, however, that foreign cuisine is symbolically significant when people think about where to go and what to eat. Change, say, there's less, but only slightly less, domination of men in restaurants. And there's more experience of foreign food. So, in statistical terms, in 1995, about half of our survey respondents said they had eaten in a restaurant with foreign cuisine. It was more like 80% by 2015. So that's a significant change. I think that's an answer to your question.
That very much is an answer, and a fascinating one at that. Thank you. You've obviously mentioned kind of a key thing that I think people will pick up on, the idea that this is focusing on dining out and kind of main meals, and that can impact sort of what we might colloquially think of in terms of frequency, because there are kind of more options now in some senses. So Jessica, I was wondering if you could kind of fill in the picture a little bit more for us. How do things like takeaway shops or prepared meals, like, I don't know, buying a lasagna at M&S and taking it home, how does that fit into this kind of picture?
Well, just like Alan said in relation to eating out in general or dining out in general, almost everybody uses takeaways and prepared foods in some form, especially when we unpack and think about what we mean by prepared foods. It means a whole array of different things. So speaking from the qualitative data, takeaways are typically situated somewhere between eating in and eating out, and are frequently used or mentioned or described in our kind of respondents' vignettes as ways of removing the labour from a social event at home, for example. Ordering a takeaway together is somewhat of a social event, a way to socialise in the comfort of your own home without the work of cooking a meal. And that plays into different ideas of reciprocity as well. Perhaps the host will pay for the takeaway for everyone, or maybe it's, and also for some of our respondents, especially younger respondents, would describe occasions where they would invite friends around and they would all chip into a bowl and pay for a takeaway, to enjoy a takeaway together. And similarly, you know, ordering a takeaway, especially for solo households, you know, might be a way to kind of resolve some kind of contradictions in the day's planning, or some mismatch in the day's planning between other competing practices. You know, getting home too late from work, the shop is closed, you'll get a takeaway instead. Or for others, perhaps, who are unwell and are unable to cook, or perhaps living alone in later life, will rely on takeaways and prepared foods in order to feed themselves. And prepared meals fit there and somewhere in this muddy category, you know, between takeaways and pre-prepared kind of convenience food. They're very much part of this fabric of eating, especially for solo households, but not only for solo households. So this is where, again, the work of cooking an entire meal from scratch just for oneself perhaps is less appealing. But again, nearly every type of household, from families with children to solo households to shared households, you know, use pre-prepared food in some way as a means to resolve some of the, to remove some of the work from the process of preparing a cooked meal at home. Remembering that prepared foods can range from pre-chopped vegetables put into a stir fry. So these are fresh foods and you're essentially still somewhat cooking from scratch. You're just removing the stage of chopping from the process, and an element of decision making, you know, which is a key part of the provisioning work or the provisioning of a meal. So anything from these pre-chopped ingredients to meal kits that have already assembled the ingredients for you, to a frozen lasagna or chilled lasagna, as you just mentioned, or, for example, a chilled fresh pizza, or, you know, and to which respondents often very much talk about adding fresh ingredients to, jazzing up a pizza by adding extra fresh ingredients on top, or making a fresh salad to put on the side of a pre-prepared meal. So there are ideas of what constitutes a main meal, and pre-prepared ingredients can sometimes provide part of that puzzle, but not always the whole thing, which was an interesting kind of qualitative story to think there about the practice of, you know, to think about cooking in relation to these kind of wider dynamics of fitting together and making kind of making eating happen in the context of a really busy day, week, month.
Yeah, and this is, I think, where one of the strengths of the book comes in, is the mixing of the qualitative and the quantitative, and being able to tell a lot of kind of nuanced stories rather than kind of lumping it all in together. So thank you for sort of disentangling some of that, showing us a bit of the nuance when it comes to takeaways, prepared food, and that kind of thing. And similarly, and Alan, you've hinted at this a little bit already, so I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit more about this. You all show in the book a variety of kind of types, archetypes, repertoires, I believe is the term you use in the book, of kind of types of people, I guess, who eat out in different ways. You mentioned sort of restrictive or more adventurous. So can you tell us a bit more, Alan, about what these sort of broad categories of characteristics of people who eat out in kind of certain ways?
Sure. I mean, it's in terms of repertoires, I've realized I haven't said that the average person, the mean frequency of eating out, of dining out, as we define it, is about once a fortnight. So people are doing lots of other things as well as dining out. And we look in the book at actually domestic household activities and how people fit eating out events into their domestic routines and also their visits to their friends. When it comes to designing combinations of ways of going about eating, people do it in different kinds of ways. Some people eat out a huge amount. Some people eat a large amount of convenience food, actually, at home. And there are ways of putting patterns together that are actually socially and symbolically significant, we think. We're particularly interested in the way in which people combine styles of food. So combine dishes from different kinds of cuisines and how much variety they encounter in their eating behavior. This could apply at home as well as in restaurants. Some people are fairly conservative and eat rather similar things in a routine kind of way. Other people are more adventurous and experience a wider range of both types of places to go and types of foods to eat. What we find is that preferences kind of fall into blocks. I think we call them blocks without a K, blocks with BLOCS. And if you find people who eat traditional English food a lot. You'll find they also eat American food, burgers and stuff, Indian food to some extent, and Chinese food. They are the most popular cuisines in the UK in 2015. There's a second block of tastes, which is for relatively exclusive restaurant meals, French and what we call modern British. They're more expensive foods, they're more expensive meals, they have a particular symbolic significance. There's a third group of tastes that form together, which we called uncommon, because they included the Thai, vegetarian, Italian, actually, and we were particularly interested in whether people ate across these particular blocks. So partly there's a debate in cultural sociology about cultural omnivorousness. Once upon a time, the story goes, you could see cultural distinction because the middle classes and upper middle classes liked high culture and everybody else liked forms of popular culture. If that was the case, it probably was the case in the 1960s, 1970s. That has now given way to distinction being associated with crossing cultural boundaries. So you should have tastes not only in classical music, but also in popular music. You should go to French restaurants, but you should also go to Lebanese restaurants and the like. And we think of repertoires as the way in which people combine those tastes. And what you find is that some sections of the population have a much wider range of tastes and experiences than do others. They're predictable. It's, again, professional workers, graduates, people with higher income, people who identify as white British, the middle-aged rather than the young, in this case, and London and Bristol more than Preston in 2015. Some people have a very wide range of tastes. We call them in the book major omnivores, but in popular discourse, they'd be more likely to be described as foodies. People who have a very high level of enthusiasm for food in general, and that is apparent both in the way in which they organize their domestic food habits. People who have gone to the majority of the types of restaurant and eaten the majority of types of cuisine are also likely to entertain more at home, to use independent specialist food shops to purchase things, very much more likely to say they like special occasion cooking. And that tips over into when they go to restaurants. Interestingly, I think they're much less likely to say that the meal that they last ate was a special occasion, and they're much less likely to have enjoyed it, which is, I think, an interesting feature. So they've become probably so inured to the activity that it no longer gives the high degree of pleasure that most people feel when they go to restaurants. So we asked a set of questions about whether, on the last occasion, did you like the food? Did you like the company? Did you like the atmosphere? Did you like the service? And those kinds of things. One thing we haven't said is that people think dining out is wonderful. By and large, people think dining out is wonderful. They give, they say, yes, of course we enjoyed the company and the food and all the rest of it. The people who do it most often, however, are more critical and are particularly likely to not like the service and not be particularly fond of the food. So the people who are most experienced like things less, which is sad, really, but it's good for everybody else.
Fascinating. Thank you for explaining that to us. I think it is quite interesting to see where those differences are. And obviously, the demographics in some senses are quite predictable. And we've spoken about some of them already in terms of wage and sort of class, that gender does not seem to make a particular difference. But Jess, I'm wondering if you can tell us about, are there any trends that we can see either between the locations or over time, particularly around class or ethnicity?
So as Alan was just talking about blocks of taste and sort of trends in class there, what's interesting, and another sort of debate we're having with ourselves still even really is to delineate this idea of major omnivores, those who sort of eat across blocks of taste. So they'll sort of go, you know, eat fish and chips from a fish and chip shop and eat a Michelin star restaurants and everything in between tend to be those from a more a service class background, to hold service class occupations, and tend to be higher earners and have more assets and resources. And when it comes to thinking about describing them as foodies, we found that didn't really fit, because what another interesting sort of story to come out of the qualitative data in relation to in conversation with these with this quantitative data is that everybody, almost everybody, described themselves as a foodie. And when we asked them what that means, they said, well, I like food. So foodies is a term that has developed in the literature to describe what we describe in the book and in our research as major omnivores. With a performance of the kind of practice as Alan has just described. So we are sort of doing some work to think about to delineate those terms, to take seriously the idea that especially those who have quite restrictive tastes restrictive activity in terms of engagement with types and styles of cuisine call themselves foodies as well. So I think that tells us something also about class and ethnicity, something that we unpack a little bit later on in the book. But it's the gender dimension that I really wanted to mention here, because while we say there aren't any sort of significant differences in relation to gender when it comes to eating out, they eat out with the same regularity. The frequencies hold steady in relation to gender. But again, I keep going back to this notion that meanings of such dining out practices clearly diverge, as women appear to eat out for different reasons. So the restaurant appears, according to our data, to offer a space in which women can relax. This is a word most commonly used by women describing eating out experiences with fellow diners of the same gender. And this is because the restaurant has become an arena in which to hold the kinds of social occasions that might have previously in 1995 taken place at home. But now the restaurant provides a scene where no one has the responsibility for hosting. It's an opportunity to spend time comfortably with each other without the routine domestic chores encroaching on time reserved for leisure. So suddenly having to put a child to bed in the middle of cooking dinner or being faced with other household tasks, unexpected or routine domestic chores. Or actually, even more importantly as well, is frequently interviewees would speak about how the social world, as we would put it, of their table couldn't be so easily interrupted by anyone other than the waiting staff. So women would talk about going out with female friends to a bar, for example, to socialise, but their space would be invaded by others. Whereas the restaurant appears to have become a sort of a space, a scene, a sort of a way of doing eating out together in a restaurant is a way of doing friendship, especially among women. So I think that sort of tells us a little bit of something about change in relation to gender and this sort of the role of dining out in facilitating a kind of space where women get to spend time together without being interrupted.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Which is fascinating. I'm so glad you've kind of shared that finding with us. You do mention that later in the book, ethnicity is examined as well. Is there any trends or findings on that you could share with us?
I could say a brief word. I mean, our study isn't particularly good on ethnicity because in a survey of 1,100 people, one gets relatively few people who identify as anything other than white British. But there are significant differences, and there are apparent differences between Asian and British Asian minorities who like to go to Indian restaurants much more than others. We only have Indian and are likely to avoid British, traditional British or modern British kind of restaurants. The Afro-Caribbean people in our survey were equally likely to avoid things that are described as British, but liked American and Chinese restaurants, in fact. People who are white but not British favoured the uncommon block of cuisine and were more likely to go to the exclusive ones, actually. But basically, non-majority ethnic populations tend to avoid the things that are described as British. We don't have any significant data about how that's changed over the 20 years because of some differences in the way we did the study.
Interesting. Thank you. I want to turn to kind of one of the trends, or I guess that one of the trends that sort of seems to go across all of the people that you spoke to and examined. And this was really interesting, going to Jess, what you were just saying about kind of motivations for dining out, that obviously really impacts the practical things of like which restaurants and how often, but also the meaning attached to them. And in the book, you all talk about three core guiding principles that seem to be quite widely shared about when to eat out, where to eat out, things like that. And you describe them as being variety, comfort, and concern. Alan, maybe you could take us through these?
Yes, this was our deduction from the qualitative data, essentially, trying to work out how people understood what dining out was and what made dining out enjoyable, how they evaluated it. I've talked a little bit already about variety. It becomes an important distinguishing feature in the way in which people go about doing things. But whether you have a lot of variety or a little bit of variety, you still say, variety is a good thing. So in the qualitative interviews, people actually apologize for not being varied enough in their tastes or not having enough of a tolerance for unfamiliar foods. So variety is at the leading edge of what you should be doing when you're when you're dining out. It's not that that wasn't the case in 1995, but it's probably more pronounced now. And as people have experienced more variety, I think they've become inured to thinking that that's a good thing. But they don't want to go and have dining out experiences that they find uncomfortable. Basically, people go to the sorts of places that will suit them and their friends, their networks, the people they go with, in relation to how they want to eat out. There is a sense in which people were scared of restaurants in the 1970s, 1980s, in the period before eating out became the kind of common and routine and regular activity that it is now. Some people, omnivores again, probably, feel comfortable in lots of places. Other people feel comfortable only in a few. But importantly, they can select the ones that they feel comfortable in. And everybody agrees that you should be happy and relaxed, and that the setting is part of the condition for that being the case. The other thing is that everybody ought to have an opinion. This is a sort of a discourse around dining out. People should know about eating out, they know about options, and have opinions about what they eat. So some of the explanations or the depth of knowledge varies depending on one's experience, but people talk a lot about eating out. We ask an attitude question about that, and people do indeed talk a lot about the foods they've eaten. They exchange views and describe experiences, which requires a knowledge of the dining out scene, what's available. And I think what's interesting is that almost everybody, whether they're very kind of widely experienced in alternatives or not, subscribes to these three principles. So that's important in terms of class relationships, in the sense that it does seem that those people who think that variety and it's also variety of manners. Let me say, I mean, some people quite like formal places. Other people can't stand them. And that is part of a way of expressing class differences and distinctions, anyway. But it does seem that there is a general consensus that these are the kinds of things that you should look for in your experiences of dining out. And that's what people told us.
Fascinating. How then does these three things fit into the trends you've seen over time in sort of the restaurant industry or the eating out industry, which the book sort of sums up as familiarization and diversification in some senses? How do these three concerns sort of play into those two trends?
Mm-hmm. I mean, both these two trends or processes have been going on for quite a long time. Familiarization, Jess described it earlier on, is people are kind of have got more used to it. They've been to more restaurants. The experience is more casual, more comfortable, less special occasions. People dine out midweek more than they used to in the past. There's less planning. Lots of people say, the last meal I ate out, I decided less than an hour before I got there that we would go. It's mostly we. Relatively few people still dine out in restaurants alone. which is because they basically feel comfortable with the activity of eating out. They become familiar because they've done it a lot. Diversification is probably initially generated by lots of different commercial alternatives. I mean, there are many more kinds of places that you could go to, different kinds of cuisines, the number of cuisines has increased and so forth. People have more opportunities than in the past. These two things relate to one another in the sense that more diversity means there are for people who, for instance, don't like formal dining, can find places that they would like to go, so they become more familiar with eating out. And equally, commercial provision comes to meet the needs and requirements of different sections of the population. So they dovetail together. Familiarization is more about, to some degree, more about the consumption activities of the population. Diversification is a bit more commercially driven, but they're related to one another. They, in some senses, tug against one another, though, because diversification emphasizes the style and the aesthetic aspects of eating to some extent, whereas familiarization is getting used to it being an ordinary kind of activity. So they are overarching processes. They have been going on for 60 or 70 years. So they didn't start in 1995. You could see them before that, but they have probably accelerated in the period between 95 and 2015.
So this is obviously addressed in the book, and to some extent, it's sort of the elephant in the room. So I'd love to talk a bit about it. Can you maybe tell us about some institutional changes or explanations for sort of why these things have happened? Maybe a bit of sort of the reasons behind that acceleration?
Yes, sure. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, we are very concerned about... we're sociologists, we want to explain in terms of wider social and cultural trends, changes, what's going on. And I, at least, fairly keen to, I think, in terms of a trilogy of commodification. I'm sorry, these are all ications and isations. They're the ways that sociologists deal with social processes rather than individual motivations. But commodification, connected to kind of increasing affluence. I mean, people spend a lot larger proportion of their food budget eating out in 2020 than they did in 1960. It's gone up from about 10% to 35%. And that means that commercial enterprises of one sort or another, the supermarkets as well as the restaurants, are commodifying more of the activity of eating. At the same time, I should say that, I mean, most people still eat most of their own of their meals in their own homes, but nevertheless, commodification is one process. Globalization is another. That's a master process of the period since the Second World War, where foreign influences on food, international supplies of food, international migration, and the circulation of ideas about eating have all accelerated in the period since the Second World War. And a third process that I think is important, I would describe as aestheticization. It's a mouthful. But food is a bit more like art, or sold under pretensions of being beautiful and of high quality than it once was. And this is one of the things that I think did accelerate quite a lot between 1995 and 2015, associated with celebrity chefs, with changes in the way in which meals are constructed and the like. So eating becomes not just a functional activity. I mean, it never was just a functional activity. And issues of health and nutrition and eating enough aren't the most important, or are only among the important things involved in eating. And eating beautifully has become a more significant process. But they say these processes are quite long and continuous. But they explain some of the ways in which the cultural understanding of dining out occurs. They in turn are related to changes in kind of social structure and social arrangements. Different household compositions, smaller households, the aging of the population, the involvement of women, greater involvement of women in the labour market, to some extent, very slow but significant changes in the gender division of labour in the kitchen. So men cook a bit more than they used to. The shift from Britain being an industrial society to being a service economy are all part of the process that encourages the kinds of cultural trends that one can see, not just in the field of food, but in the field of fashion, in the field of drinking, all sorts of things. So commodification, globalization, and aestheticization between them account for significant forces in the ways in which dining out is shaped and culturally understood.
Thank you for explaining the processes and how they weave together. It's a very powerful answer to part of the title, looking at change over this time period. But of course, I want to talk about the other part of the title before we finish, which is continuity. So maybe, Jess, you could tell us what's not changed during this time period and why you think that might be the case.
Sure. Well, just thinking back to something that we discussed earlier is that, you know, people still really enjoy eating out. So dining out is still very much a source of pleasure. And it's still very much, and okay, sticking with what hasn't changed. we would say that, you know, this practice of eating out in England over the last 20 years has only really seen moderate shifts towards people eating main meals out more frequently. And the change is really subtle, so it's really not as great as we imagined, and that's partly because of our focus on main meals. So when people dine out, they dine out for main meals, hence the frequency not changing particularly significantly. And slightly different occasions are being reported, with a large rise in one course meals, as we say, this process of casualization. While the casual dinner is occurring more and the special less, quick or convenient meals are especially likely to be unplanned. They're perhaps embarked upon on a whim, the spur of the moment, or because people are hungry. That was the case 20 years ago. So as I was saying, the passage of 20 years alters the meaning of the practice slightly as eating out becomes more ordinary, and sort of brings forth some sort of new forms of sociability, but they're not really new forms. People are reporting in 1995 getting together over a meal as a key form of sociability or celebration, and that is very much something that hasn't changed, despite there being more frequently reported kind of more casual events. So we don't see these two things as kind of operating in tension. While there are maybe fewer special occasions, people have just simply become more familiar, you know, as Alan just mentioned, as one of these trends, this familiarization and diversification. And traditional, what I'm trying to say here is that it's the kind of, I guess, the traditional sociability has been moved to new settings. So sociability among women, for example, as I mentioned earlier, being more able to relax and enjoy the freedom not only from food provisioning, but also from other domestic tasks that might compete for their simultaneous attention. So the restaurant or the cafe or the bistro or the pub with that serves food are kind of settings in which they can move their kind of form of sociability to another setting where they might be less disturbed. So as I say, even the frequency of eating out has increased only moderately, and it's just the meanings that perhaps carry greater significance. But I suppose one other thing to mention is that, you know, in saying that the things that haven't changed are perhaps, you know, the overriding aspect is that eating out or dining out brings a great deal of pleasure to most, is that... Given that, and we are making this argument that frequency has changed relatively little, that people also forget how much they eat out. So this is a kind of something that I noticed in conducting the qualitative interviews. Respondents can underestimate frequency. So they would be in the process of describing their last occasion in some detail. And about halfway through this account, of quite a more remarkable event, you know, a particularly memorable restaurant or a planned occasion. And then they remembered actually that their last occasion, for example, was in fact a more impromptu event, perhaps a day or so ago. You know, oh, hold on a second. Actually, they're in the middle of talking to me about having gone out for their partner's birthday. They say, oh, no, I had a curry on the way home from the train station last night when I bumped into a friend on the street. So... there's sociologically, that's pretty interesting to us because it tells us a lot about how our measures of how we are measuring change has to be sort of tempered by the fact that we are recording accounts of the last main meal eaten out. And when it comes to, and hence changing the name to dining out as opposed to eating out, because eating out has become more varied over the last 20 years, but dining out sort of does hold rather steady as a practice that is still, you know, holds significance. It's special, perhaps not as special as 20 years ago, but it's very much enjoyed and it's part of sociability, of doing friendship, doing family.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think that's really interesting to think about kind of the human side and like, oh, wait, hang on. You're in the middle of an interview and suddenly they remember like, something that's quite significant that they maybe hadn't thought of. And that does show us kind of in kind of that one small example shows us a lot about what has changed and what hasn't. So that's a great way to kind of finish us up. Thank you. So I really only have one question left, which is this book obviously does a lot of really interesting comparison between two different parts of the past, 1995 and 2015. But for this very last question, I'd love to look to the future, if possible, and ask perhaps if there's anything any of the three of you are working on now or next that you'd like to give a little sneak preview of.
Well, I'm very much sort of continuing with the same kind of concepts that we work with in this study of dining out. I'm particularly interested in looking at how modes of provision mix and connect in a Caribbean context, in a kind of post-colonial but kind of ongoing kind of imperial context, and thinking about practices of eating in British overseas territories, for example, how they're organised and how they might change in the future in order to address problems of food insecurity brought about by economic, political, social changes. So my argument, as it were, or what I'm trying to work on here is to think about how understanding and mapping practices of eating, as we've done in relation to dining out here, might be done in this context as a way to understand the potential for transformation or reconfiguration of practices to be more sustainable and food secure.
Intriguing.
So that's what I'm thinking about at the moment, slowly.
Intriguing. Thank you for sharing that with us. Alan, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, only to say that I'm trying to broaden out from an understanding of continuity and change in dining out to wider aspects of eating in the UK. So I'm looking, trying to write a longer study of British food habits, not just dining out, from the Second World War up to the present, in the understanding that 20 years is a pretty short period when you're thinking about cultural change. Things change all the time, but they change relatively slowly. And one of the things I deduced from the study of 1995 to 2015 in Eating Out is that you need to take a longer historical view of what's going on if you're actually going to understand and explain the changes that one does see. I mean, change is pretty continuous. There hasn't been anything that you would describe as a food revolution since, well, it certainly wasn't between 1995 and 2015. And I'm exploring that in a bit more detail.
Fascinating. Well, thank you both for sharing a little bit about your next project. They both sound very interesting. If they become books, maybe we can have you back to tell us about them. But while you are off working on those projects, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, which again is titled The Social Significance of Dining Out, A Study of Continuity and Change. Thank you so much, Alan and Jess, for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.